Michael Tesarian has articulated the state of our collective mindset and what has been influencing it, as only a handful of people on this planet have done. He's used his incredible mind, combined with truly scholarly research and a deep understanding of humankind, to come to some conclusions that you may already know in part, or in some cases, in whole. And he has put the story together in his new DVD, The Architects of Control. It's a sober look at how we've been herded and manipulated into becoming a compliant global society, one that serves an unseen master. Let's go to Michael. Michael, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a couple of years. A lot has happened. You have, you've done a couple of major projects since then, including this new DVD that you've just put out, which really is phenomenal, The Architects of Control. Very profound work. And thank you for making time for us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me back. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. There was something in that DVD that just jumped out at me, and even though this isn't a beginning point, I thought we might go ahead and toss it out there as a place to begin anyway. It has to do with Zygmunt Brzezinski. Now, interestingly, he was trotted out on MSNBC, the Rachel Maddow show here, just two nights ago as this elder statesman, and he was very clear, very logical, and I had, you know, I was having my own feelings about him. I was waiting kind of for the other shoe to drop, and I thought, geez, he's making sense here. This is frightening. Your video clip, the video clip on him in your video, he's saying something that is just amazing. It's so obvious. He's saying he was deeply troubled by a, quote, massive political awakening, thus obstructing our ability, we want to get back to that our part, to deal effectively with the global political turmoil that this awakening is generating. What is up with this, and what is his kind of being? What is the role of someone like him in shaping our perceptions for this entire epoch period of time?
That's what they do. That's exactly their paid job. They are not the architects of control, but they are very key lieutenants upon the, you know, geopolitical board game. It's these Brzezinskis, Eagle Burgers, Weinbergers, you know, George Soros. You're talking about an entire coterie here who obviously, just even by studying the length of time they remain in power as advisors, will lead people to realize that the Obamas and the Clintons and the Bushes have really no power at all, because they're in for a couple of years, just like any manager or executive of a corporation. But it's these other types that you're addressing who are there for the duration. This goes also from other federal orgs, particularly the Federal Reserve, where the 10 years, almost 14 years, and it can extend and even beyond that, you see. So these are the real, as I said, they're not the architects of the plans that they execute, but they are certainly key figures that, you know, still remain within the camera eye. To understand how they work, of course, and remember, these are people who belong, have membership with the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, you see, and other organizations that are actually controlled out of London. So the Brzezinskis, and I have the quotes from these people. I mean, I have, from their own memoirs, you can go and see it. You can also see how much time they actually spend in Britain, shaking hands with dignitaries and royal figures. If people look at the different other orgs that they belong to, like the Royal Institute of International Affairs and so on and so forth, and the Brookings Institute, you see, and all of these institutions, they're either controlled by the Jesuits on one side, and behind them is the British government. You know, they all work in collusion. But how these individuals actually work, what their actual function is almost like, you know, the way, in, I don't know if they have it in America today, but certainly in the old, in England, at a roundabout or at a junction, when the, you know, when the traffic lights are busted, then you have a policeman come with these two sort of, you know, luminous things on his arms,
yes,
these bands, and they point, you know, they direct the traffic this way and that way. Well, what happens is these characters are sent out whenever the geopolitical game, you know, has altered or changed in some way. And this, of course, it alters quite a lot. And so these guys run into the street, and their job is twofold, basically. One is to distract you. This is a very important aspect of what they do, is to break a lot of china and blow a lot of fog horns and warn you, you see, and sort of distract you so that you're not really looking at the movements or the agenda of the real players, the ones who are very, very camera shy, who are not people's champions. They're not known except to, you know, people who made a study. And so these Brzezinskis want to distract you over here. They appear on Charlie Rose. They appear on these chat shows, which millions of people will watch. They banter a back and forth a bunch of, you know, pseudo-political jive. They bash the other side. They keep the illusion of the red versus the blue, the Republican versus the Democrat. See, they'll always be constantly underlining those particular issues. They'll always speak in political terms, familiar terms. They'll never let you know what's really going on. So they're distractors, first of all. They're like Pied Pipers who play a certain tune, and then everybody sort of in this sort of hypnagogic state follows these kinds of people, believes in them, votes them in, reads their books, and so on. And the other function that they do at the same time, you know, because it's like what the right hand is doing, you don't see the left hand. Like General Archibald Wavell said, you better watch what both hands are doing here. The other technique that they use, the other strategy, is to lead you or lead the people at the same time. So they, first of all, distract you from what they don't want you to see, while at the same time they point you, point the herd, that is, in a direction that they do want you to go in. So they become then people's champions who say, hey, it's cool down this way. I've been down this road. This is the way we need to go. And of course, then you're in the position of having to analyze their what they're about. Where are they really pointing? And of course, by now, a lot of people listening to you, I'm sure, and people who certainly check out my work are aware that the road that they're pointing us down is towards this global village. You know, it's like the stuff we addressed in the DVD and throughout my work, is that I don't care what side of the political spectrum they come from. It doesn't matter what, you know, other allegiances or affiliations, you know, they have. Most of the people in the mainstream today, almost without fail, you know, and this goes for the big movers like, you know, Blair and Clinton and Bush and all of these people are always pointing us down the road to this, you know, very much a technotropic, technotronic. In fact, I think Brzezinski has already even come up with the term technotronic age. So they're pointing us down into this sort of a road that might lead us first to some sort of a glittering mirage of the global utopia, you know, the global village. But actually, the only problem with that is that the train isn't going to stop. It's not going to let you off at that wonderful, shining utopia. It's going to keep plowing on until you arrive at this post-human world, you know, just like going to a Holocaust. And by the time you're actually able to disembark, it'll be at a very different stop. They're just going to lure us there by going, climb on board, first class tickets here, first-class seating, and beautiful scenic route to the global village. But, of course, they don't tell you that they're not going to drop you off at that point. They're going to keep on going until you arrive at this abyss of the post-human technotronic age. In the meantime, they've got to do their card tricks and they've got to wave their wands to keep the people on that train entertained to death. So you're not really noticing the countryside. You're certainly not noticing that the train has veered off its original course and is heading into a ravine. They want to keep you distracted. And part of this distraction is to keep a lot of tension and anxiety going, you know, which they do through the media, and then come along with the Brzezinski touch and say, well, we've got it all solved. We've got it all understood. We're going to apply the Band-Aid now. So everybody can just go back to sleep. So these people's champions, they're amazing to watch, and people need to, you know, start analyzing what they're saying, read their books, and learn how this game, this geopolitical game, is played.
Yes, it is quite interesting because you're not talking about any dummies here. The people that have chosen to and been chosen to occupy these roles are very astute in terms of their understanding of how the human system, not just how affairs, it's in Zbigniew Brzezinski's case, but how the human mind actually works. I mean, these are masters of mind control in addition to, in his case, for example, offering up such astute and clear observations on our current, you know, geopolitical situation, as you say in Pakistan and Afghanistan the other night. It's like, well, this man makes total sense. Then you listen to his private statements, such as the one that you featured. This is a whole different ball game. Let's talk about how the mass control. In fact, there's a book, Mass Control, that you point out. This is really important. How are these people feeding into this mass control of us? How are we? Why are we buying it?
Because you see, these people, they have understood that what man's basic drives are, and that there's basically in the ego, there's just basically two main complexes, which is the prohibitive drives, which stop us from doing, you know, immoral acts or acts that we might beat ourselves up for, you see. There's that voice, and that's usually an inheritance of one or other of the parents or both, and it's certainly an inheritance of the system, the world. We go to school, we get trained, we watch how other people get punished for doing evil deeds or bad deeds or immoral deeds. We know we'll get involved with the police if we go and steal or, you know, break into neighbors' houses and stuff. So from very early on, we learn that, you know, what not to do. Then you have the other side, which is permissive. This is the complex that within the ego that doesn't suppress you from doing certain things that you want to do. When you discover the psychological the anatomy of the ego, you find that those same things exist in the outer world, and these characters and the people that control them are very aware of this balance. The balance of power externally and politically is actually based on the hot and cold, you know, the frontal lobes as opposed to the limbic realm. There's different ways you can describe this. Again, it's the punitive versus the permissive.
Yes.
It's the good versus the evil, and so therefore they have understood that in man, who they actually do believe fundamentally is their creation. By the way, I've talked about this in my Atlantis book. We're talking about that they even believe that we are their creation to do with as they feel like. But without even getting into that, basically what the strategists do is they're saying, look, and believe me, I also think that, you see, the people that we're talking about, these Illuminati or these Freemasons and these people who are in control of the system, they're divided amongst themselves into two basic groups. And what I'll say now explains a lot of why they do the crazy things they do. One group actually believes they're the utopians or the Olympians, you know, and perhaps Brzezinski is one of these people. They believe that, look, man has been and always has been tremendously primitive. He's not advanced. He's not scientific enough. He's lived in a dark age. He's actually experienced several dark ages. He's a bloodthirsty, primitive, bone-chewing, a spear-chucker, who's absolutely recalcitrant. If you read through the works of Aldous Huxley and Bertrand Russell,
yes,
this is the school that they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And so these Illuminists and these Fabians are going, what we are doing is the same as what Plato did and what any good philosopher does. We are midwifing this rabble, this recalcitrant horde, to a finer plateau of civilization and, a sense of normalcy. The place where we're trying to get them to go, and it's very difficult to get them to go because they're wild and they're unruly, and they need to be culled. So these are the people then who are very much against any type of revolutions, any type of revolt, any type of iconoclastic kind of person, you see, who tries to throw a spoke in the wheels. Mm-hmm. That's why they don't like the primitives. They don't like the fringe groups. They don't like the New Age. They don't like the mystics. They don't like, anyone who is talking about tribalism or any of this stuff that's, you know, smacks of the old world system where man is a primitive sort of village dweller. Mm-hmm. So you have this coterie who's saying, what we're doing is midwifing. We're good guys. We're your brethren. How come you can't understand? Why can't you roll up your sleeve and take our injection and take our microchips and take our RFID cards and take our global one world order? Don't you know it's all for your best? And they absolutely believe this. Now, in the same lodge, in the same group of people, you have another coterie who examine the same phenomena but have come to a completely different conclusion. And that is that man is absolutely dangerous when he becomes enlightened, civilized, and educated. He's more of a threat. He's more unruly. So what we need to do is we need to take away even the perks and the benefits that he already has. And, of course, this movement, by looking at what's going through America now, and, of course, this does change, though, it looks like this movement is in control at the present time because they're scaling back, they're pulling up the ladders, layoffs, outsourcing, endless illegal immigration and all of the above. And also don't forget the incredible spate of foreclosures and things that are going on. And even, people can date this as far back as even 1929, the Depression, when for no reason whatsoever, the federal government, basically closed up the shop, pulled up the ladders, and broke the back of the middle class. So this coterie, and there's other names, you see, of people who believe this, they believe civilization's too good. And people who find this hard to understand, they think, what's he talking about? Only need to remember, in Southern America, when the first universities were open to the blacks, or go over to Oxford and Cambridge University when the university opened doors, had to open to the working class after the First and Second World War, mm-hmm. and the students standing there and with their arms crossed with, angry, defensive looks on their faces, watching these trolls and proles coming into their sanctum. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. I mean that there's a coterie who couldn't give a damn about you. They're thinking that the pigsty is the best place for you. It's the same old upper crust, upper stiff upper lip, you know, schoolboy network people, the Prince Charleses of the world, who are even on record saying, I'd love to come back as a virus to wipe your asses out.
Yes.
Prince Philip and the whole horde of his coterie, his brothers, sipping their, clinking their champagne, thinking, these dogs, they have it too good already. We've given them socialist parties. We've given them labor parties. We've given them cars and houses and benefits. We've given them all sorts of goodies. You know, and look at the way that they're becoming more unruly, more despiritualized. And so there's these swaggering upstarts believe that keep these people in line, like a military general, keep them in the boot camp, keep them in line, keep them organized, you know, keep them performing like it used to be the old serf class. Now,
yes.
It's interesting that to find out that these two voices, these two coteries, come from the same cabal, but they're split down the middle. And they've even learned how to work a good cop, bad cop. And if you start looking through, forget history, just take the history of America, what do you see in play? You see this exact rhythm of first you have the utopians talking about development and progress and staying out of everybody else's way and not giving a damn what happens over there because we've got the answers here and we want business and we want, you know, wealth at home and we don't bother with anybody else. Progress, progress, progress. And then you have the other side scaling it all back, closing down the heavy industries, you know, letting all the rabble from Europe into the country and all of the above. So when you see this flow, and this includes the, you know, the declarations of wars and all of this, because these guys fight this out in a pillow fight. This is what is happening on the geopolitical board game, is them having their pillow fight about which one of their schools is going to win. And we see the results of this.
But they're not
This is the incredible thing that's going on.
They're not genuinely at odds with each other. They're
no.
Symbiotic.
Absolutely. This is the way the game is played when you play soldiers.
Yeah.
This is how you do it when you have Wellington on one hill and you have Napoleon on another hill, both sipping out of the same wine, drinking the same champagne. Each of them have a photograph on the wall of the other. We have to learn how this game is played. This is the geopolitical sorcery, and they're not interested in how many millions die. That's all part of the ritual of life.
Collateral damage. Mm-hmm.
Collateral damage, and it really doesn't matter because they think of us as their creations, and they think of us as a bunch of unruly people who either they have to browbeat into wanting to the palate, to acclimatize our palate so that we have an understanding of true civilization. They think in their eyes that you know, we just don't get it. And the other crowd saying, oh, no, don't even give it to them. What the hell are you doing giving it to them? Give these guys the stick and the boot in the face. That's all they'll understand. And this is why you will have through life, even if you just track the biographies of individual despots, they fall precisely into these two categories. You'll find despots who are tremendously humanitarian, from the same royal houses, from the same institutes. And this is what you see when you're talking about the Brzezinskis. You'll have some guys who really do even a lot of good in a way. They also all really do believe that man, you know, as recalcitrant as he is, with the correct midwifery, can progress. And a lot of their rhetoric, as I said, will appeal to that part of our egos that think, you know, hey, it's good cop. Hey, this works. Yeah, you know, I can handle that. I want to go up a gear in my status, in my class, in my education level. And, of course, there's a healthy drive inside of us that wants that. So these people deal with that healthy drive. Then you've got the other crowd who, as I said, are punitive. They go, don't give it to those people. And believe it or not, there's a necrotic part of our own consciousness that also feels the same way.
Yes.
We find it in individuals, in guilt, in self-sadism, in martyrdom, in victimhood. I'm not very good enough. Oh, God hates me. I'm not very good. I'm a underachiever, blah, blah, blah. And so they actually identify with that crowd going, it's okay for us to stay in the slums. Then I don't need to be, developing myself. I don't mind having a stern, tyrannical leader because then at least I know where I need to sleep and where I need to go and who's going to, give me my bowl of soup. And somebody else takes responsibility for my life. And there's millions of people in the world quite happy to go along with that kind of gig.
Well, that's very true, to avoid any kind of personal responsibility, primarily because we haven't been taught how to take responsibility from within or without. And part of the problem I see between these two schools, as you're referring to them, is that it's also now, even as we're trying to wake up, creating an incredible amount of confusion and as you say, the alternative investigative community, because you have their actions seemingly at odds with each other and continually invalidating each other. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then it creates confusion for all of us to try to figure out, well, what is the game? No, that's not what he said the other day. They said exactly the opposite, and on and on. So we need to really start looking at what is the larger picture? Who are they? And we talked about this a little bit in our last interview, but let's just go for a few minutes back into who they are. Let's talk about source, because this is a rather arrogant source.
Well, remember, this is a monumental question that directly affects me, because that's what I've been doing in my work, is to focus mostly on the 14th level of the pyramid. You know, what is that disembodied capstone? Who is really running from the top? That's always preoccupied me. We don't have to doubt that there is that coterie, because as I show in my Atlantis book and other work, these guys are screaming it loud enough. Mm-hmm. The Giuseppe Mazzinis, the Adriano Lemmis, and the Adam Weishaupts, and all of these people are saying in their own records, in their own memoirs, there is another body that operates above us. Woodrow Wilson has said it. The head of Harvard University back in the 1950s has said it. Felix Frankfurter has said it. Even other people who are insiders, like Dr. Carol Quigley, for instance. I mean, you can't think of an academic more higher up the totem pole than him. He's literally Bill Clinton's mentor.
Yeah.
The mentors, the hidden secret mentors of most of the people you see in the camera eye, have written it in their own works. Top generals, top colonels, people from even within the church, the whistleblowers. Because, you know, when I deal with my sources, I go straight to the horse's mouth. And these people, even at the senior levels, have always said there is some other overarching force, you see, that's a little bit invisible to even us. We're not quite sure of its identity. Well, my goodness. Then, you know, my question was then, let's get even if it's not a very good one, it's kind of blurry or whatever, let's try to get a profile, you see, on that coterie. Can we maybe, you know, intuit, you know, something about it? And as a matter of fact, you can. My source, of course, personally, can't speak for anybody else, but my source has always been the myths and legends of our ancestors. I happen to find that the myths and legends of the world have infinite amount of information on that particular coterie. They are never ceasing. You know, we got 30,000 records, and those are only the ones that remain that talk about Atlantis, that talk about the fallen angels. You know, they're spoken of, my goodness, even within the Christian community, within the Jewish holy books, within the rabbinical tradition, within Christianity, within Mormonism. There is nowhere you can turn that doesn't speak of this. So when people say, that's just science fiction, that's just George Lucas, how wrong they are, because there's nowhere else you can turn within academia. You turn to the Norse legends, you turn to the Vedas, you turn to the Puranas, you turn to the Aboriginals, you turn to the Maya, you turn to the Aztecs, you turn to the North American Indians, and almost every advanced tribe of Native American Indians we're talking about here, the Hopi, the Anasazi, mm-hmm. you know, the Navajo, the Pueblo, the Cherokee, the Iroquois, all of the groups, not to mention in Africa even, you see, everywhere, and many books have been written. So we know that all the world, and remember, that's only what's left. That's what hasn't been sequestered and burned and torched.
Right.
And yet of the records that are even left. So, and I would say that the Irish record, and that includes the Arthurian legends and whatnot, includes the Welsh and the Scots legends and whatnot, defeats them all. You don't need to bother with all the other legends. Just go straight to the legends of ancient Ireland, and there's a whole story there. And so even though it's everywhere you turn, doesn't mean that people have the intelligence to read seriously those legends. No, they've been brainwashed into believing it's all fairy folk tales. There was no such thing as Atlantis. Graham Hancock can go and photograph it for you, and people still don't believe it. There's records coming in every 5 minutes of sunken cities, and all of this strange, you know, artifacts appearing, and yet people still, you know, pull the blankets over their eyes. So my interest then, right from point go, way back in 1982, and even as early as 1979, although it was, of course, the thread was like had two beads on it then. Mm-hmm. It took a while to, you know, make the whole necklace or whatever, and the process still goes on. But I suddenly realized that these myths and legends need to be taken seriously. And one thing keeps popping out of these myths and legends is the story of the gods, the war between the gods, the idea that there is an absolute distinct difference between the good and the evil, and that there's this conflict going on, and that the conflict is both an interior conflict, so it has a spiritual component, and it also has an external component. And they identify the higher ones, the elite ones, as being this Nephilim, you know, or the Anunnaki, or the Anunnaje, or the Rephaim, you see, and the Ana, and the Jedi, and all of these different names, you know, that my Atlantis book is full of. And by the way, I have the Atlantis DVD, goes even into greater depth to look at all these different questions. And that this group was originally alien, and that in the days of the old, their story was written into the myths because people didn't understand in those days what technology was. And if a machine works beautifully, it appears to be like magic. So the magical coloring and the magical complexion and the sort of bizarre, you know, surrealistic quality of these mishmashed legends, like the legend of Gilgamesh, or the Epic of Creation, or even the Norse Edda, they're kind of scrambled.
Mm-hmm.
But behind all of that, very perceptibly, is the real original story that must absolutely be taken seriously. And as I say, I repeat again, they talk about the giants, they talk about the conflict between the giants, they talk of the rise of the great pre-Diluvian civilizations, and they talk about that when those civilizations fail, the historical era arises, but that we are children in understanding. Our 11,000 years is merely a blink of the eye, you know, in terms of time. And that the program of the Nephilim has never gone away. And that the Nephilim have a bloodline. This is one of the most intriguing aspects. That bloodline I refer to as called the Brotherhood of the Snake or the Dragon Court.
Mm-hmm.
This is what a term that was coined by William Bramley in his book Gods of Eden and also picked up by Lawrence Gardner. And it's a perfect description. And doesn't mean they look like serpents or snakes, but it's a metaphor, it's an emblem, a symbol of wisdom, of knowledge, and we still see that symbol on the corporate, especially the medical corporations,
right,
and in plenty of other places today. So all over the technical corporations, we see the apple with a bite out of it, we see the Sun Corporation logo, we see all of the symbolism there, and it's because these orgs are funded and controlled by the same bloodline. And the bloodline is originally, and this is very, very important for Americans to understand, is that they do not have a democracy there. They've never had a democracy there, and they never will. It's an aristocracy. It's just an aristocracy that is camouflaged. But the, you know, people who've studied the bloodlines and these bloodline connections know absolutely that the Bushes are not only connected to Charlemagne and to mass-murdering psychopathic kings like Edward I Longshanks, the Hammer of the Scots, but also back as far as Constantine. We're talking, as I said, Charlemagne. We're talking all the mass murderers of the world coming out of the royal houses, and I list all of these people in my work. All these the politicians and many others who are even behind the corporations and businesses of America, let alone the media and everything else, actually are blood connected to these royal dynasties.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that can be hidden. It's absolutely factual.
Well,
and even when they're not bloodline connected, they're ideologically connected, meaning that they're Masons, they're Templars, they're Rosicrucians, and they're Illuminati. They have direct connections to the great lodges of the world. And behind those lodges, behind the Illuminati, is, again, the royal figures. Always the Illuminati has been put in front of us, you see, as anti-monarchy, that their big thing was to bring down monarchy. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Illuminati and Adam Weishaupt was created by the royals of the world, and we have their names. We know who they were. They were members of the Hanover House. They were members of the Habsburg dynasty. They were members of the Saxe-Coburg dynasty, members of the Windsor family. And in fact, Adam Weishaupt spent the last 40 years of his life. I mean, people just think he wrote a book and then he just disappeared off the face of the earth. What did he do after he retired? He spent 40 years as a guest in the royal houses of Europe, specifically of the people around Charles de Lorraine, who was a duke, a prince, one of the greatest nobles in Europe at the time, who funded the Illuminati, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also got the Rothschild dynasty to keep funding Adam Weishaupt's Illuminati. Charles de Lorraine funded them personally, and his brother funded the Illuminati, and then when they pulled back a bit, they ordered Lord Rothschild to continue the patronage of the Illuminati throughout the world. And when Adam Weishaupt's time was over, this guy spent the last 40 years of his life in the same royal houses, wined and dined, just like Winston Churchill and others have done in future ages, wined and dined by these people. And yet on paper, to this day, people who are writing on the Illuminati will tell you, with a big straight face, that these people's whole premise was to bring down the church and bring down monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, excuse me, did you turn over two pages at once or something? Where did you get that information? It's total nonsense.
Right, Well, now let's take that even a step further back. So we're looking all of the different indigenous civilizations you mentioned earlier. We have the depictions. It's there in stone. It's in mud. It's everywhere of the people coming from the sky, right? As you say, the ETs. Now, so I assume what you're talking about here has to do, as with Zachariah Sitchin's work, we're talking about the fact that they consider us to be their creation as a genetically engineered species, perhaps mixing native DNA, Earth DNA, with ET DNA. Now, doesn't this, if this is how it started coming down, then doesn't this make us a highly programmable species from the beginning? I mean, we have been programmed from the beginning, have we not?
Well, this is the crux of my work. Everything that you see in the world today and everything that you see in history, leading back to the advent of the first historical empires, meaning approximately 10 to 11,000 years ago, is the result of exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Man, and of course, most behaviorists know this today, that if you traumatize a human mind, you know, we know this even from Kathy O'Brien, you see, and Arizona Wilder, and people who've actually been physically traumatized in this life, that they get disassociated.
Yep.
Now, the most disassociated, psychically fragmented, schizoid creature is the human being.
Mm-hmm.
And it's of no fault of his own. Not only was his DNA interfered with, that's his biology, was literally genetically engineered, and so that caused a huge rift. Basically, every man walking, every woman walking is two human beings in one. And the fragmentation can continue from there onwards. Secondly, they have the War of the Gods, which is written about in all the epics again. That was so globally devastating. Then you had the flood, and then there was a second flood, which included a pole shift. So it's almost like it was a bad day for the human race,
yeah,
you know, 13,000
years,
years ago.
Yeah.
A very long, bad day, you know, and the sum result is that the consciousness as we know it, that holistic consciousness that not only perceived holarchy, not hierarchy, that was in direct connection to the goddess, meaning the universal intelligence that is nature, that is your body, that is all the macrocosm and the microcosm, we were directly tuned into that. All of our circuitry was open. Just as Bruce Lipton says, we're using point something, something, something of our consciousness, and
right.
We call that, you know, we actually have the temerity to call that consciousness,
mm-hmm.
when all of this other stuff is, you know, there, latent.
Mm-hmm.
So that one day was opened. That was all opened at one point. Man shuts down, all the lights go off in the building. It's like a power cut, and only the janitor with his little flashlight is pottering around on the basement looking for the light switch, and that's civilization today.
Yes, that's
what he can illuminate. Yeah, the ghosts and the chimeras and the shadows, that's what we have taken for a reality that's so preposterous. But the sum result of these traumas is that when the historical era opened, and what the semblance of consciousness, I should say, that janitor, that little security guard, is the ego. What we have now is, as I've always described, is that the ego is the ghost that arose from the grave of the self. That is so weak, even though it's a very tyrannical little creature, it is very fragile ultimately. It's very fragmented. And so that's why the external religions exist, because for the emotional succor and for the emotional stabilization of that little ego being, it requires what has now become this palava of religion. It also needs physical handrails, you know, which is then provided by the establishment and so on. So this trauma accounts for everything. The ego is massively defensive. In fact, some psychologists have described the ego as nothing more than a mass of defenses. And so anything that comes in to threaten the ego or those who have an ego is immediately attacked violently. Like the Course in Miracles says, we turn our defenses into violence and then blame the other, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So this projective stuff that Jung and Freud talked about is then the bane of humanity. Because nature exploded all around us, we have lost not only the umbilical connection to nature, we're also in subliminal hatred or antipathy to nature. Not everyone, but the majority of people, not consciously but unconsciously, are still threatened. Because remember, this happened like a second ago in historical terms. So we have this fear of nature, plus we have the alien DNA that doesn't even belong on this planet. So now that's why you see the planet in exactly the kind of toilet situation that it is today. Is number one, the descendants of these Nephilim couldn't give a damn. They're unwelcome guests partying at the mansion. They're not going to pick up a plate or take their cigarette butts out when they leave.
Yeah.
Quite the reverse. And the rest of us, you know, we're lollygagging around. And that's why the world is in the state that it is, because we subliminally have a subconscious, unfortunately, subconscious hate of old Mother Nature that we feel stupidly, you know, we erroneously feel, blew up in our faces, and therefore the ground of being, the most stable thing in our ancestry, you see, you know, went up against us, and this also was an aspect of the trauma. So therefore, it is absolutely child's play to take this human creature who is like flat on his back, and just basically put him on a few strings, give him a few handrails, give him a few, you know, love scenes, a few card tricks, a little pyrotechnics, a little nudity, and he is absolutely in pig's heaven. You know, nothing else is going to traumatize his mind. The Huxleys and the Bertrand Russells and these Brzezinskis know that, and so it's just a big game to them.
But, and yet, underneath all of this, the part that starts really intriguing me, and on a personal level, I've had my own experiences over the last 20 years, and some of them have been journeying back in time, and I've kind of watched with great interest as all of the various stories are coming together now to see where we're starting to get some overlay. And one of the things that is intriguing me the most here is that in spite of all of this, there is something of an innately much, much higher and more refined level in human beings than we have been allowed to remember. And it is starting to bubble to the surface. I mean, and we could probably talk for days about where that crossover, where that intelligence force initially came from that is us, or that consciousness that is us. But nonetheless, through all of this, aren't you seeing this around in day by day in increasing numbers, this remembering, this waking up? Isn't this the part that's really frightening them?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And this of course, is tremendously antithetical to them, because they're making the world into that toilet, because they subconsciously, being super psychopathic, we have to understand something. This is why the DVD series Architects of Control was conceived, is because what we're doing is diagnosing for people, in layman's terms, what a psychopath is. So when you look at these creatures that appear out of royalty and out of government, no matter what smile they've got on, no matter what color face they've got, no matter what kind of, you know, car they drive or hairstyle they've got, you know, we have to start understanding that these people are mad, mad as hell. They're crazy. The Napoleons, you know, the Pol Pots, you know, the whole shebang, the Stalins, the Lenins. It's not just something of the history books. These guys are still with us today. It can be proven. I make reference to a book which, you know, your audience definitely needs to know about, which is called Death by Government.
Yes.
Which will absolutely show you, this academic man has written stories showing that the governments of the world kill more of their own people. This is a thoroughly documented work that shows that governments kill their own nations more than they do even during times of war when they pester somebody else. They're on record as murdering their own people more. So we're talking about one of the most toxic things that you could possibly conceive. So they turn the world into a toilet because, of course, they don't want that kind of energy, both geopathic, which is an extremely important aspect of this, the whole geospheric concept. I go into that in the Atlantis book and all throughout my work. And they also don't want it in the consciousness of man, because they know, as I've said before, that the zombie that they've created is only kept a zombie because they're constantly drip-feeding you with the Datura. Should the Datura dry up for even 24 hours, you know, so to speak, what will happen is we'll all start regaining our consciousness, because ultimately we're not their creatures. We are creatures of a much higher intelligence.
Exactly.
And also simply, yeah, and it may be a cliche to most people, but, you know, I will say it again happily, is that good cannot be destroyed by evil. Evil can never conquer good. It's simply not possible because of the way nature's ordinances are. Nature may tolerate violations of her laws and nature and her ordinances, but the one who suffers from evil is evil. Like Socrates said, to harm another is to harm oneself. The evil one is the cancerous one. The evil one is the diseased one. The evil one is his first own victim. He lives in fear. He lives in hate. He lives in defensiveness. I've said time and time again about when I've done, you know, presentations on the difference between holarchy and hierarchy, is that before the visitation, hierarchy would have been like lunacy. You would have looked at it and wouldn't have seen it, because it takes a psychopath to see it. It's like one of those little, you know, where you have that little, what is it, the paradoxicon of the vase? And can you see the faces, or do you see the vase?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Or there's that sketch of the old woman and the young woman,
yes,
you know, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And some people just can't see the Escher's one or the other. Well, that's what
work.
We're talking
about. Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. So this, and Escher is, of course, a great example. And what's going on here is that only the psychopath sees a hierarchy, because hierarchy, in point of fact, doesn't exist. Nor could you talk a person who sees it out of that delusion. So it's just a comment because there's nothing you can do about it. The fact is that holarchy is how it works. This has been proven scientifically since the advent of quantum science, but it's been spoken of as early as the Vedas by every mystic worth his salt, has described the holarchy of life, that everything is interconnected, the parts are in the whole and the whole is in the part. But to see the one definition of a psychopath is he can't see that. So we then are creatures of the holarchy. And that holarchy, as Bruce Lipton has shown, as Deepak Chopra has commented on, as Barbara Marciniak has pointed out, as Barbara Han Clow has pointed out, the photonic energy within our cells is as a receiver. It's also a generator. Consciousness affects matter. You know, I go into this in my own work about the inner zodiac stuff.
Right.
And all the rest of it, and the microcosm, you know, are connected, meaning psychic energy, physical energy are identical. There is no two separate things at all. All shamanic organizations and groups know this. All mystics, any scientist worth their salt, like the Teslas and the Walter Russells of the world, know this. Healers know it. Homeopaths know it. Only the psychopaths don't know it because they can't see it. You could point them to it, and they wouldn't see what you're seeing. It's like Tennyson said, you put a straight stick into a pool, and it looks bent. These bent ones, that's all they can see is the bent stick in a pool. They cannot see it straight. So we are now dealing, in the last chapter of the Atlantis book, I talk about the homeopathic purging of our planet and our system of this virus, this kind of pestilence. You don't start by beating them over the head. They've got the perfect right. If you watch Disc 2 of Architects of Control, I even address this at great length, that don't be telling them they got no right to do what they do. They have the right to do what they're doing, but you don't need to buy it. So what we have to do is homeopathically remedy our own immune systems. This is understood by people who understand yoga, true magic, and true martial arts. You strengthen and develop your own immunity so that their jive doesn't have the slightest effect on you. You've already won the game, and they're going to fizzle away into nothing. But going with your placards and your, you know, ideologies and your little partisan belief systems, or worse, fighting in the pig pen that they've created for you in which to have this wonderful charade, is going to be of no use. It hasn't been of no use. You can create a dozen more parties, a dozen more ologies. You can create a super socialist party, a super green party, a super conservative party. You can come up with any. You can move the Rubik's Cube of politics and social activity in whichever way you want, and it's going to still remain a cube. There's nothing you can do. It's just moving furniture around on the Titanic. It's good fun while it lasts, but it is absolutely not going to remedy the main situation at all.
Right, because that's mostly a mental game for people, just to make them feel as though they have the illusion of control, when in fact, as you say, the true nature of our own control lies much deeper within, and it does really require our beginning to reinstitute some basic principles, such as nature does indeed heal. This is a beautiful planet that we've been cut off from.
This is right, and the neuroses can be healed. The zombie can be healed.
Yes.
Anything that, this is the beauty of healing, is that anything that went warped, absolutely, you know, remember, nature is the greatest healer.
Yes.
If we're not getting healed, it might be because we're turning to the same sorcerers who created the problem in the first place.
Yes.
So, another trait of the traumatized individual, and this is extremely important for people to note, is that the traumatized person, it's called Stockholm Syndrome, is when you identify with your oppressor.
Yes.
In the LA talk that I did called the 2012 and the Future of Mankind, I addressed this very deeply and went into it a little bit more detail and said that it's actually really called the identification with the object of your hate. Mm-hmm. But without even getting into the sort of tangents, basically the slave identifies with the master. The slave even wishes he was the master. And as we see in society today, the generation of people who are screaming about tyranny given power, become the next generation of tyrants.
Yes.
You know, or they become lackeys of the tyrants, you know, i.e. Bono, and people like Geldof, who's this poor man's Mick Jagger. You know, I mean, what on earth are these creatures doing? 1 minute screaming in the face of Margaret Thatcher and screaming in the face of the Queen of England and all of this, and everyone's following them like the people's champions, the Pied Pipers, telling you they're all for humanity. And the next minute, they're down on their bony knees, you know, getting the highest awards of the land, and corporations are opened in their name, and they're big wigs, the Nelson Mandelas and all of these, you know, charlatans.
Yes.
So, you know, again, this is part of the wake-up call here. But getting back to your very important question about the healing, is that when you have some sort of pestilence in your midst, it's a relationship. You are equally culpable when the parasite's influence is upon you. Parasite can't live without something you're giving it.
This is very true. And in fact, you make a big distinction where you're talking about there's a big difference between being sold a lie. It's their right to sell us a lie as beings. Anyone can do what they wish, as you say. But it is not our directive that we must buy the lie. We don't have to buy it, no matter how hard they sell it. Yeah.
You don't. And therefore, that puts I've always said that they have control. They don't have the power. We have the power. They can bamboozle us mm-hmm. and hypnotize us to think we have no power. It's like there's a great scene in the movie The Devil Rides Out, in which the black magician who's actually in the process of hypnotizing a lady. His words are, though your eyes are open and you seem aware, you are in fact beneath my control. Mm-hmm. So this is what is happening with the human race. We've been deluded. We've been given so much voodoo that we actually do not believe we're in our power. This is how they thrive. You see, evil has no power whatsoever. The only power or semblance of power that it has, it's actually a control. That's why we call the series Architects of Control, is because the control that they have assumed is actually given to them by us the moment that we're out of our power. This is how any parasite operates. If you don't have the mosquito net and you don't have the right ointment, well, this mosquito, don't blame it for eating you alive. If the rat has appeared in the sewer of all your fecal matter, hey, don't blame the rat. If the maggot has appeared in meat that you've left out in the hot Californian sun for 5 days, don't blame the maggot.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, it's ludicrous. So us going, no, 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 no. What are these rats doing down here?
Yep.
Please get away. and like we're doing with all of ecology, we're always suppressing something. We're always band-aiding it. We're always cutting it off. We're always burning and slashing it. Instead of going, hang on a minute, what are we doing? So my work is very much to say you are equally responsible. If you see something you don't like out there, and I don't mean to, you know, say I'm Carl Jung or anything here, but again, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. We should have worked this out by now just from our own physical relationships. If you see something out there you don't like, you are bringing it into being. That doesn't mean beat yourself up and cause yet another problem of self-sadism, but analyze the situation in a cold, detached, and objective and loving manner and say, okay, I see what I am doing here that perpetuates this particular evil.
Yes.
This is the way that, and we're at this turning point now, so to get right, you know, round to the question you first asked, yes, I do see the light that is coming, because the light is basically that now mankind has the opportunity again, and it's partly because of the movement of the planet Pluto and various other archetypal things that are taking place. We do have an incredible moment in history at exactly this point that has never happened before in the history of time before, in which man can suddenly begin to be a true homeopathic person, in meaning that he can truly diagnose the problem, meaning that he truly, for the first time, unlike his forefathers, see, our forefathers, even just a few hundred years ago, first of all, their lifespans were so short, and their thinking was completely indoctrinated by religion and what have you. And thirdly, they didn't have the data in front of them to even make the connections.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a detective saying, listen, I can't move in for an arrest because I don't even have clues. I only have suppositions. I feel it in my gut that this person is guilty, but I don't have any actual data. 14
yeah.
years later, you meet the same detective. He goes, I've got the data. We can now connect that it's just too many coincidences here. Okay, there's too many inconsistencies. Now you make your move. The human race can now confront the tiger in the long grass because we've been through the jungle, we've had the experts, we've had the whistleblowers, we have the insiders, we have the people doing the work and the labor, and slowly, slowly, slowly now we get in as Bill Hicks said, the squeegee on the third eye. We can intuit what is happening now and start to change the dynamic instead of rushing out like a bunch of mad, sort of crazy berserkers and then just be shot down like, you know, we're just like, at the circus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now we can actually be properly armed up to take this particular kind of sorcery on with a new magic of our own that really, is the solution.
And I want to share with everybody a quote that is in your DVD that is so powerful. And in fact, I think you said the same thing. And that is, we can accept that God can become man to save man, but not man becoming God to save himself. That is huge. Why it's been so hard for us to believe this, but the time is dawning. As you say now, that there is enough knowledge out there, there's enough evidence to show that there's something more to us than, quote, being a slave species to the controllers, that we can indeed become our own gods and save ourselves. And you go on to talk about something in this area that I found just profoundly wise, and it's very true, and this is the hard part. we look around, we see the people we love, we see the society around us. If you have an open heart, you want to help everyone you can. But like you said, is it the responsibility of someone who is waking up to essentially allow themselves to be used as scaffolding for people who are falling down and not doing the work it takes to bring themselves up? This is a really big one. We have about 10 minutes left. Can you talk about this part of it? Well, who do we owe what to?
Well, first let me address the point that you made about the man being his own God. That was a quote from Vernon Howard.
Yeah.
And very quickly, I'll just say that that is entirely backed up by all the scriptures. Mm-hmm. We have the Gospel of Thomas. We've got Corinthians. We've got the church father Origen. We've got St. Paul. You know, St. Paul said, if thine eye be single, thy whole body will be full of light. You know, Jesus in Corinthians has said, if you are the temple of God, for the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. You know, in John, you have the same stuff about the inner temple that Jesus is on record of saying, you know, what I can do, you can do also and more.
Yes.
You know, so we're not making anything up here. It's not New Agey. Man is his own God, and it's preposterous to believe that he couldn't be. It's really preposterous. But then moving on to what you said about this whole idea of dependency, this is, of course, crucial, because those people who do set themselves up as the fixer or the rehardwirer of other people who are in a state of delusion are very far from understanding the metaphysical underpinnings of everything that happens in the world. It doesn't mean they're not good people and they're not moved by goodness, and they definitely want to fix people and definitely are motivated by virtue. I believe they are motivated by virtue. But unfortunately, under those principles is something even more deep. A deeper understanding of human nature, of why evil comes into our world, of how you must also allow the person the right to fall and fail, because that is ultimately the greatest teacher. Let's say it's presumptuous to even try and fix. You know, isn't there a quote in the Bible, before you can take out the beam, before you can take out the splint from somebody's eye, you have to take out the beam from your own eye?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a certain primitive logic in the fact that, wait a minute, you know, I can't even fix my own gig here. You know, what can I do for somebody else? The next step to that is saying that, look, if you do fix your own gig, you are helping somebody else, because by your model is the best way and the most egalitarian way to have other people, fix themselves. Moreover, if you get in to try and rehardwire somebody, even on a political or even a physical level, even one-on-one, the problem with that is that you are actually violating their sovereignty. And it doesn't make the crime any less just because they let you violate their sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Very, very true.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, the truly spiritual man doesn't allow a friend to lose his sense of independence, because true friends enhance their friend's independence and are vigilant to make sure that you do not become dependent. Number one, they are not dependent. They don't make themselves dependent on anyone, except in a very casual, mercurial manner, which is inevitable in the world. But I'm talking about emotionally or psychologically here. And moreover, that friend will refuse to act or be in any way, you know, culpable to let you do the same thing.
Yes.
This is what makes a healthy, sustainable relationship.
Yeah.
And it's also helps the world. And all the other bastions in the world, all the other edifices do the opposite. They're itching to make you dependent. And they also try to instill, and the point in the DVD was really about this, they try to instill this pseudo-virtue in you, that it's right for other people to become dependent on you. It's wonderful for you to be the teacher, the fixer, and the martyr. Hey, history's full of it. You're meant to sacrifice yourself for the good of other people. Whether or not you know what you're doing, or whether you know that you're mucking in there, might even make things much worse, that you may even blame a person later on. They say, look, you know, the best thing, you know, do you know how many psychologists have written in their books, Regina, that they have 101 patients who are of the wealthy class, literally driving up in convertible Mercedes, coming in their $1,000 Gucci suits, lying down on the couch and saying, hey, doc, I wish I had some pain in my life like your other working class patients.
Okay.
This has become a common cliche now.
Yes.
But they're going, and you can see it if you watch the movie Sex, Lies, and Videotape. They have a piece on that in
yes.
the beginning. And they're going, yeah, you know, dog, I wish I had some pain and agony, because everything's too easy. You know, I there's something wrong with me. I feel numb.
Yeah, but that's part of the program, isn't it?
Yeah. And then they say, I envy those people who've had a bit of suffering in their life. Carl Jung is on record to say that the source of all neuroses is the avoidance of legitimate suffering.
Yes. Yeah, and you feature that. You feature that well, or speak to it well in your DVD, by the way. I mean, for anybody that's listening, they really need to get a copy and see that whole entire part. But
there's an old mystical adage. I think it's from the Greeks, and certainly it's in the Vedas, that the gods do not throw anything your way that you cannot handle.
Mm-hmm.
And two, the gods being so benevolent, throw at the good man, at the great man, they throw the greatest sorrow and the greatest ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to stint, because it's like the Count of Monte Cristo. They're going to dump the worst agonies on you, or they're going to give you the greatest wealth. So it's almost a mark of a person's greatness that they have had to, you know, walk the Siddhartha road of both agony and ecstasy.
And it's interesting, because what's so critical about your message right now is that as the structures around us are beginning to crumble, not just throughout the Western world, we're looking at global change, meltdown on many levels, we're going to have to be extra diligent in terms of our understanding that it is up to us to save ourselves, to become our own gods and save ourselves, because the temptation is going to be there to deplete our forces in every way, and be encouraged to deplete our forces to save the rest. And I'm not saying this, and we have to understand, this is not a selfish type of pursuit we're talking about here. It's beyond self-preservation. It is a sovereignty issue, is it not?
And that's right. And sovereignty cannot be found on the political, social, or relational level until you have it internally, spiritually first. This is why my message is ultimately a spiritual one, and I have no time for political, you know, shenanigans.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Michael, thank you so much. I just love chatting with you. We could chat for days. And what I wanted to find out is, I'd love to go. I'd love to have another round with you on your Irish origin story. This is really important, but that requires another hour or two. So hopefully when you have time, we're going to pick up there, if that works for you.
Oh, I'd be delighted. You know, that's a great thesis, a great subject. I'd love to do something on that. Yeah.
Okay, thank good. That'll be our next stop then. And so meanwhile, happy trails to you while all this stuff is coming unglued. And thank you so much for your just incredible brilliance and insight that you're sharing with all of us. And I highly encourage everybody to pick up a copy of the DVD. Very, very well done. And I think, you know, we have to understand, though it can look a little bit bleak in terms of seeing what we have been programmed for, I think the latter part of this conversation shows that that's not our fate. We have a choice. And I think we forget we have a choice. I think we don't even know we have a choice. We're having to remember that we even have a choice.
That's right. We always have the choice. That's the main thing to remember. And again, you know, that's a choice that corresponds with who we are spiritually. It's, you know, the other stuff is like, you know, debris that we need to work about how to remove it. And we've just been using the wrong tools in the past. But absolutely, the choice is always going to be there in front of people.
Well,
freedom or enslavement, you know, freedom or enslavement, it is a choice.
Yep, and you're giving us some wonderful tools to work with. Thanks again, Michael. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thanks, love.
I strongly urge you to pick up a copy of The Architects of Control and have some friends around for the viewing. It's certainly going to inspire some deep conversation at the end. But remember, it's our choice as to how this story progresses. It does not matter if the picture is bleak right now. We have the creativity, the heart, and the innate power to trump the controllers at this game if we choose to wake up. Until next time, thanks for listening.